Please remember to watch your language.
Look, I can't speak without swearing, and I've only got my grade 10, and I haven't had a cigarette since I've been arrested, and I'm ready to f***ing snap. So I'd like to make a request under the People's Freedom of Choices and Voices Act that I be able to smoke and swear in your courtroom. Because if I can't smoke and swear, I'm f***ed.
The following programming may contain content that some listeners find offensive. If you are sensitive to foul language or explicit content, please turn your radio the f*** off now.
It's the Black History Month edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, Black History Month, the why and the what, gun violence, and what is an ammosexual, and the Atlantic slave trade, what you need to know. Let's begin episode 328.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross-sort, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of sparks. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars, our other sun. We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. Joining me in the Radio Freethinker virtual studio is Gulid. Say hello, Gulid.
Hello, folks.
So, as every one of our listeners has to know, February is Black History Month. So I thought I would give Gulid a chance to explain to us what is Black History Month, what it means, where it comes from, and wherever he wants to go with this. So as the whitest person in the virtual studio, I'm going to shut up right now. Gulid, why don't you tell us, what is Black History Month?
So Black History Month, or National African American History Month, is basically a month dedicated to honor and earn and celebrate the achievements of Black women and Black men throughout history, particularly in the United States, North America area, but it is applied all around the world.
So, no children, Black history?
Children as well.
Okay. So, when was it enacted?
So, it stems from Mr. Carter G. Woodson's Negro History Week. It basically came about as he noticed that there wasn't much Black history or contributions of African-American history mentioned in the curriculum at the time. So he sort of brought about the Negro History Week, and it's February specifically because Abraham Lincoln and Frederick Douglass' birthdays are within the same week, and those are very relevant figures when speaking on Black history.
Cool. Actually, I must confess, in doing my research for this, and again, even someone as smart as me can be a complete idiot at times, there's a very famous thing in American politics called the Lincoln-Douglas debates. And for the longest time, I thought that was Abraham Lincoln, which it obviously was, but of course, as Gulid, you obviously know that had nothing to do with it. It was actually Stephen A. Douglas, who was a political adversary that Lincoln faced early in his career, and had nothing to do with Douglas, although slavery was one of the major focuses of that debate. But I digress. So when did it first come to Canada?
So it came in the U.S. in 1976, and it's been celebrated here in Canada since 1995.
Who introduced it?
It was introduced by Jean Augustine, who was the first African-Canadian woman to be elected to the Canadian House of Commons.
She was also the first African-Canadian woman to be appointed to the federal cabinet as well, which is cool, I guess.
Which is, yeah.
Although, to be fair, 1995 does seem to be, how shall we say, a tad late in coming to the let's have someone who is not white in parliament. Although, I guess just because she's Black doesn't mean there wasn't maybe an Asian or First Nations person.
Right, right.
But so it came to Canada. What does Black History Month then mean?
It really looks at achievements and really, I would say, contributions made. It also looks at events throughout history, that are relevant to the country, and yeah, that are just relevant in general.
So what relevance has any black person ever done in the history of humanity?
Well, I suppose it would be no different than any other human being or cultural group. It's just relevant in this month because we're sort of condensing contributions made by this particular group of people, because we don't really hear about it in curriculum or news or platforms such as those.
Can you think of any famous ones?
Yeah. So for an example, there are many magazines in the States, many magazines that were sort of catered to the majority of Americans, i.e. white people. And then came Ebony magazine, which is an magazine that catered its content towards the African-American demographic. And it became increasingly popular because you get to hear about information and news from a different perspective.
There's also, of course, Carver, the peanut guy.
Oh, yeah. George Washington Carver, who gave us peanut butter and 300 products, different products from peanuts. Extremely relevant figure, and one that we often hear about during February.
Yes. Another person that comes to mind is Charles R. Drew, who was someone who actually did a lot of research in blood transfusions and basically created blood plasma or something akin to that. Sadly, I remember it. Sadly is probably not the right word. There's a famous episode of a TV show called MASH, which you probably don't know of, but those of us who have been around for more than a year knew, that had mentioned that he died because he was in a car accident in the southern United States, and he was denied access to a hospital because he was black. And the very thing that he had sort of developed would have saved his life if only they'd let him in. But from what I understand, that's somewhat of a myth, but it's still an interesting twist to the idea that so you have a number of people who are of black heritage, and yet there is this prevalence of racism throughout our history. How does Black History Month play into that historical context?
It portrays a lot of the positive of a particular group of people that have been, for the most part, portrayed as negative and generally just not as equal as the other demographics in America.
Out of curiosity, how much do you think that the history of slavery in the United States led to the development of Black History Month and that whole need for it versus the history of slavery here in Canada?
I think the history of slavery is extremely relevant to why a Black History Month was needed in America. African Americans were only being portrayed as, for the most part, slaves throughout education in the curriculum and throughout history in general. And we weren't really looking at how many contributions they've made to America, as well as how far they've come from that past history.
It's interesting to note that the first black woman to win an Oscar award was Haley McDaniel, who won it, ironically enough, for Best Supporting Actress in Gone with the Wind. But of course, she was at the time playing, how shall we say, your stereotypical yes, mammy, housemaid kind of role. But things have changed quite a bit. But then again, have they? Hasn't there been sort of a kerfuffle with regards to the number of people of color represented in the Oscars and that sort of thing?
Yes, the Oscar so white controversy, which has been being talked about a lot. There have been numerous actors and actresses of color that have performed in movies, and very few, if not any, have been nominated for awards, and the Oscar nominations are not diverse at all, doesn't represent the amount of motion pictures that came out this year or the amount that deserve awards. At least that's how a lot of people feel.
How do you feel?
I feel like there are a few actors, in my opinion, that did deserve an Oscar nomination. I'm not 100% knowledgeable on the movie industry in general, the film industry. So I know that the board that decides who gets nominated and ultimately who wins is majority is white. So that does have an impact for sure. But I don't feel like the awards are very diverse this year.
So how do you think that reflects? I mean, you would think that the way our societies work, at least vis-a-vis history goes, that, I don't know, things would be getting better, right? So one of the things I was thinking about, maybe one of the reasons why things don't seem to be getting better, at least in the recent state, is you have had sort of, I guess, a huge step forward, is you had Obama, the first black president in history, although technically only half black, but that's a question for another moment. And that because of the absolute, antithetical attitude, at least a significant portion of American culture is to him, that you're getting a certain degree of bleed over into other aspects. I mean, to be fair, I did a little research, and there has been less than, I think, 10 nominations for best actor or actress, supporting or otherwise, prior to 1970. And then the numbers suss out a bit until you get into the last couple of years, where it's back down to that, you know, under 10 kind of thing. So maybe my question is do you think that the United States now is more racially charged than maybe it was in the 90s?
I want to say yes, although I might be a little bit biased because I didn't fully grow up in the 90s, so I haven't really lived through that history or witnessed it myself, but from what I'm seeing now, I want to say yes.
And I wonder also, based on that sort of assumption you have, that maybe things are getting better in one sense, that even if you're getting this, how shall we say, neglect, at least from the Oscar nomination committee, which honestly, in the grand scheme of things, who the heck cares?
Right.
But the fact that it's being noticed, and you do have the hashtag Twitter wars kind of thing, that if this had happened in the 70s or 80s, it would have been, oh, that's not a good thing, but, you know, mind your place. Mm-hmm. Whereas now it's like, holy crap, we this is happening now. And we're not going to just sit back and sort of take it. And so you have a sort of a sense of greater empowerment. So I guess I have one thought about this. Do you think that this sense of empowerment is real, or is it just made up? And I guess what role Black History Month may have played into that?
I would say that this is real, and that is a good point as well. Now this sort of, I don't want to use as strong of a word as injustice for something like a Grammy Oscar nomination, because in the grand scheme of things, you are right. It isn't that relevant. It is a lot more transparent now, and people are having that conversation that they wouldn't have had, you know, during the 90s and during the 80s. So I would definitely say that this power that's coming about is very much real.
And of course, you didn't want to use the word injustice, but we could bring in, you know, the elephant in the room of injustice. And we have talked about this before on the show about the Black Lives Matter.
Yeah.
And that. So how does that play into this? Or what are your thoughts about how this plays into Black History Month and that sort of thing?
I feel like this month sort of strengthens that movement as they pay attention to positive, relevant figures throughout history that are Black, and it does show that, or at least it does sort of re-emphasize that Black people are very much just like everybody else and do matter.
But I mean, don't we have like Martin Luther King Day? Isn't that like good enough?
It depends on who you ask. In my opinion, Martin Luther King was an extremely positive, relevant figure to America's history, to the civil rights movement. You know, he's infamous, I Have a Dream speech, him advocating for uniting people of all color and creed. But just having that one day, I don't think is enough.
And then you could flip that around on a certain degree, saying, I mean, Martin Luther King Day didn't really become a national holiday, at least in the States, until the year 2000. So maybe, again, one of the positive spinoffs of Black History Month is to make it possible to celebrate someone who, as you say, is in many ways quite a controversial figure in American history, Martin Luther King.
Yep, so that is true as well. Sort of relooking at figures such as Martin Luther King, a lot of good can come from that.
That being said, again, you know, as a member of the Caucasian race, I do sometimes have to wonder what the hell my people are thinking. But in states like Alabama, Arkansas, Mississippi, it is actually known as the Robert E. Lee / Martin Luther King Day. So combining two surprisingly connected, if somewhat antithetical, figures in history together.
Yes, that's very interesting. I was not aware that they combined both of those figures. Yes. But it does show sort of where that those areas are at racially. Or sorry, I shouldn't say racially, but in racial relations.
That is, yes, it's almost like having Christmas is really Satan / Jesus birthday day. But yeah. such is life. So one of the whole points of Black History Month is to try and raise the consciousness of the contributions people of African origin have had to our culture, to our history, some of the struggles that they've had to go through. I've already sort of tried to nail you down on some of the positives. Are there any notable struggles that Black History Month should bring out so people know that where we've come from is something that we shouldn't forget? In the same way that, you know, people of Jewish origin will sort of have the Holocaust, you know, never forget, and they want to maintain knowledge of that so it never happens again. What would you think is some of the major struggles that Black History Month would rise up that we shouldn't forget?
So I think it's important of, you know, people of African origin just to remember that they come from a very rich background and rich culture. And although there are a lot of positive contributions and achievements made, there has been that history of oppression, of struggle, some overcome, some still going on today. And history does repeat itself. So it is very much important to know where you come from in order to know where you're going, as cheesy as that sounds.
Yes. And you're right, because, I mean, one of the things that we sometimes forget is that, you know, if America's great sin is chattel slavery, we often think that, you know, Canada's biggest sin is First Nations. But slavery existed here in Canada, and it was a bizarre thing in some ways, because it became such a big thing in the States because of the plantations, and you needed a lot of labor. And in Canada, at least up until the time that slavery wasn't deemed appropriate, we didn't have, you know, we were fur trappers and hewers of logs and that sort of thing. So there just wasn't the necessary infrastructure. But still, there was a strong sense of racism that exists in Canada that I think we sometimes forget, or we have to be reminded of it. One of the largest groups of blacks in Canada were actually British royalists who were in the States. Some of them, to be fair, were slaves, but a lot of them weren't. And when the American War of Independence came out, they sided with the British. And when the British lost, a large number of them moved to the Nova Scotia area. But once they were there, and you think, wow, hey, you fought for our side, and here's your freedom, and, you know, have a great life. We had this thing, there's a famous blight, and you will sometimes hear it on Canadian History Moments, called Africaville, where, again, a large segment of these people and other people had settled. And this turned out to be sort of a slum, and not a slum because the people moved there didn't work hard or anything like that. But, you know, there was no schools built there. They had no connection to the regular facilities, even though it was right next to, or really close to, Halifax. And to a point where actually actions by the city council of Halifax, which eventually took over this area as part of the expanding things, put things like prison was put in there, infectious disease center was put in there. They had like raw waste was stored there. And of course, at a certain point, you know, you get what you want, and they wanted to make Africville into a slum, and it turned into a slum. Then they kicked out all the people and relocated them, and then they relocated them. They said, oh, we'll reimburse you, and we'll offer all these supports for forcing you to move, and none of that had occurred. And again, we tend to forget that as part of our own history, but you see something like that being revisited. Again, not so much here in Vancouver, although please correct me, Gulit, if I have this wrong, but you hear a lot of the black race relationships with the cops being reiterated in places like Toronto. Your thoughts on that whole escapade?
That is very much true. Of course, the relations with the police department and the public in Toronto is very much different than those same relations in Vancouver.
If any of the police are happy to listen, Gulit's just covering his butt.
But you know, those events really aren't revisited in places like here as much, and that is very much an example of how it is important to remember those past struggles in order to not repeat them.
So one of the ideas, I guess, Black History Month, as we already sort of mentioned, one, you know, show the rich history to make us aware of our own transgressions, historically speaking. But another aspect is to, again, integrate this one member of our community into the greater polis of Canada. How do you think Black History Month has done?
Well, in terms of integration, I would say the one way it's done that is that it's shown that there are a lot of capable figures in, you know, of African origin that are very much important, and it shows that this population of people is just as capable and you know, competent and accomplished as a lot of the other groups of people that live in the world. So in that sense, I feel like it does help integrate us. But in another way, a lot of people have the argument, well, you know, where's our History Month? Or, you know, this separates you because, you know, you have your own month. So it does integrate in a way, but it can also arguably not.
Very famously, I hear that Morgan Freeman is actually someone who doesn't like Black History Month, because his take on it, that it's not Black history, it's American history. And that by, as you say, spinning this off as a separate entity, you're not integrating, but it's actually a form of segregating.
I do agree with that to a degree, because I, you know, looking at how this came about, there was no mention of, I want to say, like true Black history in the curriculum in general in many schools. So, you know, in order to fully integrate and maybe not even need a Black History Month in the future, we have to work on creating that balanced platform.
So this maybe on that sort of bent, maybe, why is it, well, we've knocked some terms around. So let's ask you what terms are appropriate. One of the things that I had heard, sorry, this is going to go to Grandma House to get where I wanted to go. Right. In a recent interview with the woman who introduced Black History Month to Canada, they had said, you know, well, you're not actually African. You're actually from, I think, Jamaica. Right. So really, you know, you're Caribbean. So why is it appropriate for someone from Caribbea to introduce Black History Month? Which leads us to my question is, you know, is it Black History Month, African History Month? There's a lot of diversity. Is it People of Color History Month? What are your thoughts on these sort of terms that often get used interchangeably?
I think it shows that, so it did sort of start off as National African American Month, or it's been referred to as that. As someone from the Caribbean, you do fall in the racial category of Black, although race is a very ambiguous form of categorizing in general. people do sort of identify you as what you look like. For example, I'm East African, and I can very much relate to, or what's going on in the States right now resonates with me. So having a month that celebrates this particular group of people, people of color, I'll say, can have impacts on people who may not be from Africa, but from places such as the Caribbean.
There's an interesting thing I had heard, and I can't remember where I heard it from, so take this with a slight grain of thought. And I think it was mixed up with the woman who claimed to be, self-identified as African-American. I can't remember her name. Do you remember her name?
Rachel Dolezal.
Rachel Dolezal. It had come up there that, you know, depending on where you are in the world, the idea of blackness or Africanness depends on the cultural context. So here in North America, by and large, one drop of African blood makes you basically black, irrespective of how light your skin tone may be or what have you. Whereas if you go to some places like Brazil and what have you, it's almost the inverse, that one drop of white blood basically means, oh, you're not African American. I guess you're not African Brazilian, but you are a sort of a third sort of, well, in Canada, you would be classified sort of as Métis if you were First Nations, because you're not, quote, pure enough. But there, they have this very different sort of mix. I assume you uphold to the theory of one drop makes you black?
Yes, I would probably be more onto that theory.
So one of the reasons why that theory holds on, and again, it's sort of, if society constructs something in such a way, then you get this results. So because anyone with, quote, one drop of black blood, at least in the United States, and again, I have to assume here in Canada, you would be discriminated against, right? So you'd suffer the same fate, no matter how light-skinned you may be. So in that sense, then, and I'm building up to something here, what makes you black isn't even really so important with regards to skin color, because as you obviously know, and everyone knows, there's a great gradient from pitch black to, you know, sort of a coffee latte sort of brownish, light brownishness.
Yeah.
But you could say, well, we all shared in that particular, you know, historical struggle. So we're all sort of black because of that. But you didn't, right? I mean, you came from Somalia.
Yeah.
You integrated into Canada and I'm more or less race-free. And again, please correct me if I'm wrong. Race-free society. So you don't actually have that struggle of racism that people in Ferguson or Baltimore would have grown up in. So does that actually mean then in an odd sort of way that you're not black?
So I can definitely see that perspective because I don't share that common struggle to that same degree. However, because I am technically put in that racial category, seeing other people that sort of look just like you being treated that way and knowing that if you were at that location, you would be treated no different really causes me to have those situations resonate with me. And it is something that I can not directly relate to, but understand.
I think one of the things, and I've mentioned this on the show more than once, that one of the huge differences between bigotry and racism isn't that the people who are exhibiting it have any difference vis-a-vis their views, but the racist is someone who has power over the person they're denigrating, as opposed to just denigrating those people in and of itself. And I think maybe, or at least this is sort of what I was thinking, is that this is sort of the other side of the coin of that. So that even if you aren't necessarily being the direct victim of racism, you still are a member of that group that lacks power. So you're still the minority, so to speak. And as such, you have that sense of identity, if not in the actual experience of racism, the fear that racism could be experienced by you.
Yeah, that pretty much sums up how I feel about it.
So now I had another question, and again, I think weird questions. It's what I do. So and maybe we've kind of answered this, but let's see if we have. So it's called Black History Month. And there have been some people who've been calling for sort of white rights group and those sort of things. And one of the things that people often laugh about the whites, the quote, Caucasian clubs or something like that, is, well, one, you are the majority, so, you know, it's kind of stupid. But the other thing is that there is no such thing per se as a white cultural identity. That is, so my own personal heritage, I can trace back to something like Wales or Ireland, Scotland or England, but that culture has nothing to do really with German or French or Greek or Italian. And yet if you called it all Caucasian history, that would somehow seem, well, I'm not sure what the right word is, but you yourself, I mean, you know, you're Somali. So isn't it actually then a way of reinforcing the idea that this is one coherent group when really it's a cornucopia of diversity? That Black History Month isn't Black History Month. It's not African History Month. It is actually, well, it's Caribbean History Month. It's Somalian History Month. It's Kenya History Month. It's South African History Month. And that by lumping it all together, you're actually, again, going back to sort of what we said, you're doing a disservice to the very people that it's supposed to help.
Well, the truth is a lot of the Africans that were, or a lot of the African Americans in America didn't come by choice. They were brought over from Africa. And although they did have their identity in Africa, they integrated and formed a new African-American identity. And much the same, the Africans that came to Canada formed an African-Canadian identity. And that is what Black History Month is about.
Yeah, I think I would add on to that and basically just repeat what you said, is that, you know, one of the things about, you know, Canada is multicultural, but at the same time, the end goal is to make everyone a Canadian of some form or another. The Americans are much more, everyone's got to be an American, and there's, you know, should be as little difference as possible. But you do have these, you know, different communities. But because you're an immigrant nation, those communities are in themselves very diverse, and that this concept of creating a quote African-American culture or quote Canadian African culture, as envisioned via Black History Month, is to cement this diverse community that is under attack in most places into one homogeneous sort of group, that it basically says, you are my neighbor and we do have a shared history, even if my particular history is not the same history as your history.
I agree with that.
So I guess we'll probably close out this segment unless there's a huge amount that you think we missed. But again, I will leave it to you, Gulit, to have the final words vis-a-vis Black History Month.
So I think Black History Month is still necessary. I know a lot of people have that debate every year it comes around. I think it does serve a purpose, and I think as society becomes more integrated, we will, and in terms of systemically, we won't have to separate different information about cultures and history. It'll be more integrated, but we will still be able to celebrate different groups that live together.
And I guess on that note, wanting to give you the last word, we'll be back after this break.
We're counting down the days till Fun Drive 2016. This year, our theme is growing our cultures, and it all starts on February 25th with a rad kickoff party in the Pit Pub and a week-long on-air telethon. Support your community station by donating to help us support training for volunteers and promote the multitude of cultures on our airwaves. The online donation page goes live on February 15th, so keep an eye out for your chance to donate and get cool CITR swag.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker on CITR 101.9 FM, your community-supported public broadcaster. Just a reminder, next week is Fun Drive, where we here at Radio Freethinker hope you will support the show and the station. You can send in your donations now. The link will be on the CITR website.
Head there and select whatever amount you'd like to pledge. Most people tend to pick the 101.9 level, but whatever you give, it will be welcomed. And don't forget to select Radio Freethinker when you're asked what show inspired you to give. And we're back. The next bit is a cut segment from Matt's Best of 2015 about gun violence and how mental illness is used as a scapegoat to avoid the real issues of gun violence in the United States. Let's time travel and listen in. Matt, what is your next top story, your last top story of 2015?
So my top story is kind of a cumulative view on the year. But my last topic has to do with the gun violence in the United States. And I wouldn't be myself if I didn't bring up the fact that a lot of it is blamed on the mental health status of some of these people in the United States. So in 2015, there were 330 mass shootings, or 307, between 330 and 370, depending on how you measure them. There were 13,000, over 13,000 deaths in total in the United States. And almost every time that any gun violence or major gun violence happens that is worth mentioning in the media, such as the recent or relatively recent San Bernardino shootings, everybody talks about how, you know, these people are mentally disturbed and things along those lines. But research suggests that the vast majority of gun violence is not committed by the mentally ill. So that is one thing that I think is at least of worth mentioning, that people kind of get that right.
I think one of the interesting things, and this goes with what you're saying, is that a lot of the gun violence in the United States is what you would almost call impulse shooting. So you sit there, you're at the bar, you get in a fight with your buddy, things go from bad to worse, you're both carrying guns, the guns come out, bang, bang, you shoot. A lot of people blame the number of guns that are in the United States. And to be fair, I think that has some participatory or causal effect. But you get other countries like Switzerland or Israel, where the gun ownership is higher there than you get in the United States, at least per capita. But in the United States, you get this weird effect that, you know, depression, which is a mental illness, but if you have a gun in the house, you're much more likely to be successful at a suicide attempt than if you don't. And those numbers are actually brought up, because when you look at those kind of violences, Switzerland and Israel do have high rates of suicide success because they have this access to guns. But in the United States, you get this wacky fetishism over guns that you don't see anywhere else in the world. And I think that is the part that plays into it. Gulen, again, we were talking about Black Lives Matter, where it seems the first response is to kill, and then the second response is to check out, to investigate. Gulen, what do you think of the whole escalation of gun violence in the United States, especially vis-a-vis the Black Lives Matter protests?
I think it has to do with the militarization of the police and how there's sort of this culture in the United States with their police force of having an us versus them sort of mentality, which causes them to react and shoot first and ask questions later. And I think that type of mentality really separates the police from, you know, the community that they're supposed to serve. Yeah. And especially pertaining to, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement in the United States, you know, it's shown that in these sort of situations, there is sort of a bias that police have towards Black men.
What do you think of the idea, though, that, you know, because there is such a high level of gun violence in the United States, that maybe even if it's done in a racially biased way, the shoot first mentality is justified because, well, odds are that person is packing heat and there is a good chance that they will try and shoot me dead. I mean, like I say, ignoring the fact that they are applying this standard in a discriminatory way, do you think there's any case that can be made that maybe the cops are actually justified to be much more gun happy than they are in Canada or the UK?
To some degree, because I think that, you know, the amount of gun usage is a lot higher in the United States. The United States has more mass shootings due to within gun violence than anywhere else I can think of. So it does cause the police to be, it forces them to have to be better equipped to be in these dangerous situations. But I still don't think that's the right mentality to have. Yeah.
Nicholas, to bring you on board, one of the reasons that are brought up why guns are so well protected, because it stands out, if you do any polling, the vast, like 90-95% of Americans, even gun owning or NRA members, believe that there should be some form of gun control, and yet the politicians just shy away from it. And one of the reasons that's given why they do this is money in politics, that you get major gun manufacturers giving money to politicians so that they won't do anything to stop this rampant gun apocalypse. What role do you think might money play in the United States being one of the most violent, gun-happy places in the civilized world?
I mean, I didn't know about how the manufacturers would bribe the politicians to enforce the rules. I mean, I guess it could happen just like any other lobbyist, but that would really suck for the American society because the politicians are not acting on the best interest of the citizens.
But isn't that just the free market working its way out?
Well, but at the same time, you're letting hundreds of people dying because of your decision, because of the money you take, you know, for your party. You're not benefiting the people. You're letting people to die, which is really unfair for the people who suffer from this.
But thousands of people die every year in car accidents.
Yes, but the politicians, the regulators, they are doing their best, or even the insurance companies, they're doing their best to try to prevent these. They're upgrading the infrastructures and stuff like that. But for the gun policies, they're not doing anything, although they know the consequences of not doing anything. But my concern is, you know, how are they going to implement the gun control if the government decided to do so? You know, what's going to happen to the guns who are previously purchased, and how is it going to, you know, control all the guns that are going to be produced in the future?
I am so glad you brought that up, because one of the interesting case studies that is used with regards to this was I believe it was the Port Arthur massacre in Australia, where Australia had, you know, one of these gun crazy guys went out, shot like 20 some odd people, and basically woke up Australia to the dangers of gun violence. And within several months, if not less, they had passed a sweeping gun control law, and they did something which the Americans have tried in limited success before, is they had what they call gun buybacks. So if you have a gun, bring it down to your local government agency, and they'll buy it off of you. And the idea is to take the guns out of the system, and then they just melted them down. And since the Port Arthur massacre, and that I think was in the early 90s, there hasn't been a single mass shooting in Australia since then. And it's deemed as one of the great, you know, see, this is what happens if you take gun control seriously. But in the United States, actually, gun control has become less recently than it was. Like, notably, there's a thing called the Brady Bill after the attempted assassination of Reagan. And it's called Brady because one of his communication guys got shot in the head and suffered severe disabilities because of the gunshot wound to his head. So the bill is named after him. And it limited things like automatic rifles and certain sizes of cartridge that you could buy. So, you know, instead of having 5 rounds, you'd buy these super cartridges that would have 50 rounds, so you wouldn't have to reload as often. And, well, very recently, that bill was actually allowed to expire. It's one of those bills that they passed that has to be renewed every so often to sort of, I don't know, who knows why. But But it's actually worse now in the United States for gun control, especially with a lot of Supreme Court cases that have come up in the last decade where local municipalities, states, or cities have sat back and they've tried to implement stricter gun control. And again, something as simple that, you know, you have to do a background check on someone before you can sell them a gun. If you're selling something that can be modified into an automatic rifle, then that's not a gun you're allowed to sell. Sort of simple rational things that don't even really limit the amount of guns overall. And these have been deemed to contravene the Second Amendment, which itself is a very complicated thing, about the Americans' quote, right to bear arms. Matt, what do you think about this whole legal framework? You know, like Nicholas says, you couldn't possibly do it in the States. And in an odd sort of way, I'm not sure you could.
I think anything is possible. I think that's there's a realm of possibilities, and I believe that with enough time, it would be possible. I don't think that in the even close to near future it will happen, because people are so married to this ideology of not touching our what the founding fathers created for our country. And I believe, just as a side point, the irony of that, because the founding fathers created that bill in order to maintain a militia. So I don't think this is what the founding fathers had in mind of, you know, make sure you keep your guns because meh.
Actually, it's funny. Guns. It's funny actually, because there's a whole area of historical debate over the comma in the Second Amendment that makes it ambiguous as to whether you're referring to guns for the militia or guns for the people. But yes, that being read, what do you think then about this whole in the United States where you get this new mythical beast called the ammosexual? You know, where again, it's not even that they have a lot of guns. In Canada, there are actually a lot of guns in Canada per person. It's just mainly the farmers that have them. But in the United States, as you said, there's this fetishization, not only the Second Amendment, which has seemed to be more important than the First Amendment, the right to life, but it's also, it's somehow so tied to the American identity that you don't see anywhere else. And I mean, I could go all history nut on you to try and explain it, but what do you think is at that core of the ammosexual? Well, first of all, are you now, or have you ever been, an ammosexual?
Oh, dear God. How did you know? Did you find my profile? And I think as in talking about a history lesson, I think the thing about why the American public is so tied to their amendments is because they gain their independence through war, through violence, through they had to fight for their right.
French Revolution.
To party. Yeah. No, but they, yes, that is also true. But the French also had a, how should I say, the French had a different lifestyle because they were surrounded by many different democracies. They were part of this European, before the European Union, but you were surrounded by this variety of life, and America has stood alone because, you know, the government from an ocean away was controlling them.
It's funny though, because this is actually more of a new phenomena. If you go back to the 50s, you even had the NRA in support of gun control, right? You know the idea of being a responsible gun owner. And it's only been recently that you get the crazy come out. And maybe this relates into the whole Trump thing and even climate change thing is, you know, there are so many things pushing in on people. And America, because it went from, you know, the great economic miracle to a crumbling edifice that maybe the Americans feel it sharper than anyone else does. But, you know, they can't control the climate. They can't seem to do anything about
their economy.
They can't seem to do anything about their economy. They feel powerless with the government. But the one thing they can do is they can hold on to their guns, goddammit, and no one's going to take that away from me.
I think you're right on that. And I think the other thing we were talking about the fear of the outside, the fear of the unknown, it just ties into that. There is a lot of factors that tie into it, but I think you really, that's a really good point, Don.
Of course, that's why it's my show.
That is why it is your show.
So you mentioned that, you know, gun violence is a big thing and that it's probably not going to end anytime soon. So why do you think last year it was the story?
I think it is just something that for me, having this gun violence being tied to mental health, because of some of the viewers know that, you know, I myself have bipolar disorder, and having this view turned on you, such as someone would view if you're a Muslim, so to speak, Gulad, like you would feel like all these Muslims are the problem. You know, it's all these insane people are the problem. This is why I wanted to bring it up, because there are so many people out there with mental health issues that don't have this voice or are also afraid to say, you know, this is not because of us, right? This is because you people are the insane ones. You know, the normal redneck American or the normal, so to speak, normal, but the regular man is, or the regular woman, without any mental health issues, they're the ones causing these problems, right? So I just wanted to make sure that that was brought up and cleared up. You know, there were governors and you know, presidential hopefuls that went on talk shows talking about, you know, why did this happen? And for one example here, the governor of Arkansas went on a show, I forget which one it was, most likely either CNN or Fox or anything along those lines, but talking about how, you know, we need to do better with mental health. However, his state, Arkansas, when he was governor, was one of the worst in the country. And it's just, let's draw all of this attention away from gun control and talk about how, yep, it's just those people were nuts. You know, they were bananas. You know, that's it. You know, keep your guns, because watch out for those bananas people and watch out for those Muslims and all this kind of stuff. It's blaming, not the issue. So I just wanted to make sure that that was brought up. And that for me, to me, is one of the most important things.
Sorry, I'm just looking at a map of mass shootings in the United States.
Oh, yeah, I have that up as well. Just for context here, the map is very focused. There is a focus in California. There are some in northern Oregon there. There are some in the, you know, Seattle area. The rest is kind of an area in the middle here in the central United States that is not very full, but practically everything east of Colorado just starts turning red.
So just avoid those places.
Avoid those places as best you can. But it's funny because you would notice that in America, where these mass shootings have happened. Oh, sorry, I'm actually looking at 2016 charts and maps. No, sorry, no, I'm still looking at the right one.
I don't know if we can believe you now.
Yeah, right. Oh, it's just, let's end the show. I am looking at the right one, but yeah. So you start seeing on the East Coast, and in the central eastern, I guess, United States, a lot of this these mass shootings, even in these small states with not a very large population, you're still seeing a very large number of mass shootings. So it doesn't just have to do with the density. It has to do with the ideologies of the area as well.
So Matt, I might want to push back a little bit here, because we have kind of said that Americans, you know, with Donald Trump and denial of climate change, they are a little crazy. And that would strike me as a mental health issue.
I think you're totally right. And actually, one of the things that is hard to deal with is the fact that we use these words like crazy and insane and things like that to describe behavior. And But it's,
I think labels.
See, it's not wrong. Yeah, label behavior, or create labels for something. And it's unfortunately, it's not wrong. Like I mentioned earlier in the show, that there is a culture insanity, or there's an issue in that culture in the United States with this kind of behavior. Now, we're not trying to pick on the United States here, although it is a very, very easy target. There is insanity, there is culture insanity in a lot of other countries. But to us in Canada, this is definitely an important topic to cover, because it does hit home pretty hard.
And sadly, I fear it will be a major topic in the year to come.
We're going to round out today's show with a clip of Web Wisdom, The Atlantic Slave Trade, What Too Few Textbooks Told You, by Anthony Hazard via TED-Ed. Let's listen in.
Slavery, the treatment of human beings as property, deprived of personal rights, has occurred in many forms throughout the world. But one institution stands out for both its global scale and its lasting legacy. The Atlantic slave trade, occurring from the late 15th to the mid-19th century and spanning three continents, forcibly brought more than 10 million Africans to the Americas. The impact it would leave affected not only these slaves and their descendants, but the economies and histories of large parts of the world. There had been centuries of contact between Europe and Africa via the Mediterranean, but the Atlantic slave trade began in the late 1400s with Portuguese colonies in West Africa and Spanish settlement of the Americas shortly after. The crops grown in the new colonies, sugarcane, tobacco, and cotton, were labor-intensive, and there were not enough settlers or indentured servants to cultivate all the new land. American natives were enslaved, but many died from new diseases, while others effectively resisted. And so, to meet the massive demand for labor, the Europeans looked to Africa. African slavery had existed for centuries in various forms. Some slaves were indentured servants, with a limited term and the chance to buy one's freedom. Others were more like European serfs. In some societies, slaves could be part of a master's family, own land, and even rise to positions of power. But when white captains came offering manufactured goods, weapons, and rum for slaves, African kings and merchants had little reason to hesitate. They viewed the people they sold not as fellow Africans, but criminals, debtors, or prisoners of war from rival tribes. By selling them, kings enriched their own realms and strengthened them against neighboring enemies. African kingdoms prospered from the slave trade, but meeting the Europeans' massive demand created intense competition. Slavery replaced other criminal sentences, and capturing slaves became a motivation for war rather than its result. To defend themselves from slave raids, neighboring kingdoms needed European firearms, which they also bought with slaves. The slave trade had become an arms race, altering societies and economies across the continent. As for the slaves themselves, they faced unimaginable brutality. After being marched to slave forts on the coast, shaved to prevent lice, and branded, they were loaded onto ships bound for the Americas. About 20% of them would never see land again. Most captains of the day were tight packers, cramming as many men as possible below deck. While the lack of sanitation caused many to die of disease, and others were thrown overboard for being sick or as discipline, the captains ensured their profits by cutting off slaves' ears as proof of purchase. Some captives took matters into their own hands. Many inland Africans had never seen whites before and thought them to be cannibals, constantly taking people away and returning for more. Afraid of being eaten, or just to avoid further suffering, they committed suicide or starved themselves, believing that in death their souls would return home. Those who survived were completely dehumanized, treated as mere cargo. Women and children were kept above deck and abused by the crew, while the men were made to perform dances in order to keep them exercised and curb rebellion. What happened to those Africans who reached the New World, and how the legacy of slavery still affects their descendants today, is fairly well known. But what is not often discussed is the effect that the Atlantic slave trade had on Africa's future. Not only did the continent lose tens of millions of its able-bodied population, but because most of the slaves taken were men, the long-term demographic effect was even greater. When the slave trade was finally outlawed in the Americas and Europe, the African kingdoms whose economies it had come to dominate collapsed, leaving them open to conquest and colonization. And the increased competition and influx of European weapons fueled warfare and instability that continues to this day. The Atlantic slave trade also contributed to the development of racist ideology. Most African slavery had no deeper reason than legal punishment or intertribal warfare. But the Europeans who preached a universal religion and who had long ago outlawed enslaving fellow Christians needed justification for a practice so obviously at odds with their ideals of equality. So they claimed that Africans were biologically inferior and destined to be slaves, making great efforts to justify this theory. Thus, slavery in Europe and the Americas acquired a racial basis, making it impossible for slaves and their future descendants to attain equal status in society. In all of these ways, the Atlantic slave trade was an injustice on a massive scale, whose impact has continued long after its abolition.
That's all the time we have this week. This is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars.